Introducing a fresh new way to save with your Kroger points. Choose between saving on fuel or saving on your next Kroger delivery order with new rewards cash. You'll still earn points every time you shop Kroger delivery. Then when you're ready to redeem your points, you can choose to save up to $1 per gallon at the pump or redeem your points to save on your next delivery order. It's a fresh new way to save. Your points, your choice. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Not available in all locations. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Before new Cascade Platinum Plus, I would pre-rinse all my dishes because my old detergent just wouldn't get them clean. But now, I do dishes differently. A no pre-wash, no rewash, money-back guaranteed kind of different. Because Cascade Platinum Plus has double the grease-fighting power of Dawn built right in, with twice the scrubbing power, giving me a clean that lets me break all the dish rules. I just scrape, load, and I'm done. Yep. So clean. With Cascade Platinum Plus, I dare to dish differently.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you are ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jay Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
You did not hear the name Eddie Garrison in that intro, but he is the guy that puts this all together. Beyond the Bricks, thanks again to Quality Supply and Tool for making it possible for us to do another installment of Beyond the Bricks, our looks at the names, the personalities, the commercials, the music, the pop culture, everything that goes into the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And over the course of the travels that I am fortunate enough to do for the NTT IndyCar Series in the IndyCar Radio Network, I thank those that come up and mention how they enjoy Beyond the Bricks. I know many of you listen to this program in podcast form, maybe even weeks or months after it airs here on our flagship at 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan, or 93 WIBC in Indianapolis. So we thank you for that. And with that, it is time once again to talk about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, because upcoming it is a return to the oval of the Brickyard 400 this coming weekend. But Mike Thompson, who joins me now, a longtime historian and audio archivist of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, we would be remiss if we did not mention the last time that we were together doing this program in the month of May. And again, we put another great month into the books and another great finish, Mike, at the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Yeah, it sure was a very exciting finish. And I'm probably going to get myself in a little bit of trouble with what I'm about to say, but I kind of wish Pato O'Ward had won the race. And here's the only reason why. I like to see new winners. I like to see different people win. And I would have loved to have seen the celebration had Pato won. And the reason I say that is I was just at Mid-Ohio a couple weeks ago. I know you were there, Jake. And Pato just draws a crowd wherever he's at, and his fans are so enthusiastic and energetic. And I just thought about that, thinking about what the celebration would have been like. I mean, Joseph's a great champion. Exciting to see him win two in a row. But I just wonder what the celebration would have been had Pato won.
There is no doubt about the fact, Mike. I don't think that's, first off, that statement's overly controversial, because number one, for the sixth time, we had a back-to-back winner. And you know, that's always special, no question about it. But I think most people kind of agree with you in the fact that you love to see a first-time winner. You like to see another name added to the list, another likeness that has never been on the BorgWarner Trophy. But in addition to that, Pato O'Ward has certainly accumulated and grown a Tony Kanaan-type fan base. And by that, we mean not only the larger-than-life personality and the excitability of him, which Tony Kanaan has as well, but the knocking on the door and the knocking on the door, and seeing 2 years in a row where Pato O'Ward was right there in the end, and then this year, a third year in a row, where he's right there, it seems like it is built up, the fait accompli, that eventually he is going to win it, and that place is going to absolutely erupt, because fan favorites are part of what make the Indianapolis 500 mile race the race that it is. And since the end of that race, when, again, to repeat, Joseph Newgarden, the winner, congratulations to him, Pata Award being passed in turn number three, headed towards the checkered flag. But since then, there has been plenty of racing, and we have had plenty to talk about, including those, unfortunately, that we have lost, that have been key members of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and its history. And that is the subject of our show tonight, talking about Parnelli Jones, who passed away just after the Indianapolis 500-mile race at the age of 90 on June the 4th. He was a rookie in 1961. He was the co-rookie of the year with Bobby Marshman, finished 12th in that rookie campaign. But from there forward, Mike, we're talking about somebody who etched his name in the record books in about every form and fashion that one could during his time racing in Indianapolis.
Yeah, and I mean, when you think about Parnelli Jones, it's just so many memories flood back. And when I was a kid, my dad told me to, you know, I was writing some of the current drivers for autographs as a like 13-year-old. And my dad was like, you should write Parnelli Jones and guys like that. He probably has a stack of photos, you know, wanting to sign for people. And I did. And I wrote him and he wrote me back. And I was thinking, you know, wouldn't it be cool to meet Parnelli Jones? And I actually got to know him a little bit through our mutual friend, Steve Shunk. And one time I was in the media room and Parnelli actually said in front of people, there's my friend Mike. And I was like, I know you'll know what this means, Jake, but when Parnelli Jones says, there's my friend Mike in front of people, I mean, I was just like, I thought I was royalty all of a sudden, you know? I mean, Parnelli Jones, he just means so much to people and he was just such a great guy. And, you know, we knew he was not doing that well, but it was just, he's just so special to be around and he accomplished so much at the Speedway. And I mean, he didn't have that long a career. We're not talking about a guy like AJ who drove 30 some races. I mean, he had a very, very short career, but he accomplished so much.
He led, I believe it's just under 42% of the laps that he turned at the Indianapolis 500 during his time. And you are correct. Parnelli was king, and those that are around him were the king's court in terms of that royalty. In 1962, he became the first driver to break the magical 150-mile-an-hour barrier in qualifying that put him on the pole for the Indy 500. After his run, he and car owner J.C. Agajanian spoke to Sid Collins on the Speedway Radio Network.
Back in Indianapolis once again, and this has been an exciting day. The air has been full of electricity since this morning when everyone anticipated the 150-mile-per-hour barrier might be broken, and there were several champions here who possibly could do it. The one who did it, the one who sits on the pole for the 1962 Indianapolis 500-mile race classic, is Parnelli Jones of Gardena, California. Now, the old record was 149.061 miles per hour for the one lap and 149.056 for the four laps. Today, a new record of 150.729 for the fastest lap and an average speed for the four laps of 150 miles an hour, .370. Here in the broadcast booth with us, the man who holds the pole, Parnelli Jones. Parnelli, congratulations to you from coast to coast.
Well, thank you, Sid. It's a real pleasure to be here. I feel real great to be sitting up front, and I think that I have a real terrific car.
You have many quotes, Parnelli, before the pole time. You said, we want to qualify the first days, even if we qualify slower, as long as we go fast enough to make the race. We can just set up front. You're really sitting up front. Do you like that spot?
Yes, I do. Although I think that race day is the day that counts, and what happens after the 200 laps, the 500 miles is the most important thing, and of course starting up front gives you just that much better chance.
Parnelli, you also said earlier this week, it depends on which way the wind is blowing. Sometimes you're better than you are other times. We'd like to sit on the pole naturally, but I'd be satisfied to be in the first three rows. How about the wind this morning?
Well, I think the wind was blowing a little west, and I kind of think that way, and I run the best when the wind is blowing west.
You mean you think west because you're from California?
Well, it was blowing toward home anyway.
You joined some famous names here in racing, Parnelli. The last 2 years, Eddie Sachs sat on the pole. Before that, Johnny Thompson, Dick Rathman, reading backwards, Pat O'Connor, Pat Flaherty, Jerry Hoyt, and going back in history, such great drivers as Maury Rose, Rex Mays, Bill Cummings, Lou Moore, Billy Arnold. How do you feel to be in that select group?
Well, that's real terrific. In fact, I like being among these fellows. They're certainly terrific drivers in the past and then right now. And I like to say that my buddy Bobby Marshman came awful close, too.
I think Bobby was terribly disappointed. You fellas have a very strong, friendly feud, haven't you?
Well, we do. Bobby and I have been running around a little bit lately together. And he and I both wanted to run 150 miles an hour. And I'm just sorry that he didn't.
Well, he missed it by a whisker. Parnell, I'll get back to you in just a moment. Here is your car owner, J.C. Agajanian. The name of the car, the Agajanian Willard Battery Special. The folks listening in California today to Parnelli on KMJ in Fresno and KCRA in Sacramento, be happy to hear from both of you, and WDOK in Cleveland, the home of Willard Battery as well. So we have the entire team here except for the chief mechanic, Johnny Paulson. But Aggie, he'll be honored at a big banquet here in town May 23rd because he's the pole position mechanic of the year. I know how you feel about your employees and your friends who work with you in racing. You're thrilled about that, I'm sure.
I certainly am, Sid. This is a great feeling, and I just can't explain how happy and how satisfied I am of my Willard Battery team, Parnelli Jones and John Paulson.
Aggie, in 1950, Walt Faulkner set the goal here for you at 134.343 miles per hour. Did you feel in those days anyone would ever drive for you or anyone else and sit on the pole at 150-plus?
Well, that usually happens once in a lifetime for any car owner here, Sid, and I'm sorry that so many car owners here have never reached that pinnacle, and I'm real thrilled that it's happened to me twice.
Aggie, you found Parnelli some years ago in California, didn't you, by watching a television program? Was that the story? He was in a jalopy race or something of that nature?
That's very true. At Gardena Stadium on Sunday afternoon, they had jalopy races there, and this is 10 years back. Parnelli was 18 years old at the time. He had just started. The track was very wet. It had been drizzling a little that day, and due to the fact that the television station KTLA was televising it, they had to put on the show, and they were going on. Parnelli was out in the back of the pack there, and he kept sneaking up on the fellas. Most of the other drivers were spinning out or hitting the wall or crashing, but Parnelli kept his car straight at all times and won the race, Sid. And I said to myself, sitting on my couch at home, that there's a race driver that someday is going to do something.
Aggie, you're a real great talent scout to pick someone off a television screen.
Well, maybe I have some talent, Sid. Possibly that's my talent of bringing rookies here that do such a tremendous job.
I think this is the hottest rookie you've had, don't you, Egg?
Well, I know he is. I'm not thinking, Sid.
Parnelli, if we can, for our nationwide audience, I'd like to find out where you got the nickname. Is your name actually Parnelli?
My name is actually Parnell. My friends call me Parnelli, and it just kind of hung on to me.
What did you think about when Mr. Agajanian came to you the first time in California and said, would you like to drive for me?
Well, he asked me, he'd been hinting around several times about coming to drive his car, and I thought, well, I better wait a while and see if I liked it back here. And I came back here with Jim Hurtubise the year he set the record. Said if anybody could ever beat him, I'd do it, but I sure had my doubts, and I'm sorry that Jim spun her yesterday and hit the wall, and he'll possibly be in another car tomorrow, and I'm hoping he's right up front anyway.
Well, beating a friend's record like that, I'm sure, gives you a tremendous degree of satisfaction, and yet, like most records are broken, you feel a little sorry about it, don't you?
Yes, I do. I know Jim. He came out right before I qualified, and he says, best of luck, Parnelli. I hope you do it, and I got to see him yet this afternoon and tell him thanks.
You know, the last February in California, Riverside Track, Parnell and I were in a movie together out there, so I have a great interest in him personally as well, having seen him come in this last race last year, qualifying fifth and finishing 12th and leading the race at one time as well. So Parnelli is certainly an up-and-coming driver at Indianapolis and now holding both records, the one-lap speed in the qualification run and the four-lap speed. That's one that probably will hold for quite some time because last year no one heard of his record, if you recall. Aggie, what was that $150 that someone poured in Parnell's helmet today?
Well, that was the car owner, Bobby Marshman. He had made a promise that any driver that goes officially 150 miles an hour, he would bring over 150 silver dollars and pour them in the driver's helmet. So he asked me to get Parnelli's helmet off so that we could fill it up with those Las Vegas dollars.
You know, he had a big silver ice bucket, and I really thought before I saw the silver dollars, he was going to pour some ice water over you. Did you?
I didn't know what, exactly what he was up to there at first, but I'm glad it was money instead of ice.
Well, that was Phil Hedback in the Bryant Heating and Cooling Special, and he's kind of a good promoter, you know, and I thought he felt for the fast, hot ride of Parnell's, he put the water on him.
He sure did, Sid. You know, he says, Aggie, we're not going to cool your driver off with this ice bucket. We're going to give you some cash. I said, okay, that's fine.
Well, gentlemen, we're very, very thrilled here in the broadcast tower, having seen many, many pole runs over our last 15 years here at the Indianapolis 500-mile race, and the 2.5-mile oval is a challenge to all. Parnell, I think you've found the secret. Congratulations to you.
Well, thank you, Sid.
And we'll have you on the air again, I'm sure, before race day. And Mr. Agajanian, to you and the Willard Battery, Agajanian Willard Battery special, good luck on race day.
Thank you a million, Sid.
J.C. Agajanian, car owner, Parnelli Jones, pole position holder. Now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
Parnelli had dominated the early stages of the 1962 race and looked like a sure winner. And then his car, the Calhoun, suffered brake failure. He finished seventh. Mike talked to Parnelli Jones about the race that he should have won, the one that got away in 1962.
62, I know. When I interviewed Roger Ward once and I introduced him as the winner for 59 and 62, he said, well, Parnelli probably really won in 62.
Well, I was. I was really long gone. I mean, of any race, as much as the Turbine, any race I should have won would have been that one. As well as the Turbine car, but you know, I could have been a 3- or 4-time winner as well, but I only ran here 7 years and finished second once in a year Jimmy Clark won in another Lotus, and so I've had a great career here, and I think if I'd have stuck around, you know, I might have got hurt, or you never know what the end results are. Not that I retired or anything like that. I just decided to quit running open cockpit cars, and that's when I drove the Trans Am and the off-road and stuff like that.
You know, the interesting thing about it, my 1962 is not even necessarily an isolated incident. There are a couple of years you could look at for Parnelli and say he could have or should have had this happen or that happen for him. But we're talking about somebody that, in the true form of a champion, seemed to always dwell rather on the great moments that he had at Indianapolis and never really pushed his chest out of the woe is me or feel sorry for me in that regard.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I mean, he's still in the top 10 of all-time laps led at the Speedway, and he only ran 7 times in the 500. So, you know, he had plenty of opportunities. I mean, as a rookie, he had a rock hit him in the eye, and he was, you know, blood in his goggles and things like that. And he kept coming into the pits and pouring blood out of his goggles, and that actually set him back, and he finished lower than he would have. And so, you know, he had a number of different things happen to him. You're right.
When we come back, continuing to look back through the 1960s, the sound, the clips, the memories, the legacy of the man that we called Parnelli, Rufus Parnelli Jones, when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. This is your dentist. Do me a favor and feel the front of your teeth. How grimy are they?
Ugh.
It's time for a Crest Pro Health reality checkup. That grime is the buildup of plaque bacteria that can cause cavities in just months. You need to switch to Crest Pro Health. While most toothpaste stop working in minutes, Crest Pro Health's antibacterial fluoride protects for up to 12 hours to stop cavities before they start. So pick up some Crest Pro Health ASAP. Smile. Crest has you covered.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
They call him the fastest man at Indy. That's Parnelli Jones, who shattered his own speed record this year, qualifying at 151.153 miles per hour in the Agajanian Willard Battery Special. For the second consecutive year, Parnelli sits on the pole for the big race. This spectacular performance has made Parnelli Jones a favorite here at the Speedway. Parnelli has a favorite too, dependable Willard batteries. Willard's got the wallop and the stamina to dish it out when called on time after time. To quote Parnelli Jones, a battery is something like a life preserver. If it doesn't work when you need it, you're sunk. For dependability, power, and fast starts every time, I know I can depend on Willard. That's Parnelli's reaction to Willard's top performance. You'll agree during the coming hot summertime driving. If your battery's weak, have it replaced now. Always insist on Willard, the battery the pros depend on.
It is during the hot summertime driving on his way to work that Chris in Illinois, who came up to say hi to me at Mid-Ohio, listens to Beyond the Bricks. And Chris, we appreciate it. Have a good day at work today if you are listening on your way. Jake Query along with Mike Thompson, Eddie Garrison here as well. It is Beyond the Bricks brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool, talking about Parnelli Jones. And when you think of Parnelli Jones, you think, of course, about the fact that he was the 1963 Indianapolis 500-mile champion. Mike, it is a year that came with a victory for Parnelli, but that's not to say it was a year void of controversy for Parnelli Jones.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that the rules were very simple. They were explained in the driver's meeting. Cars leaking oil will be black flagged. Parnelli's car developed a leak in the external oil tank, and he was absolutely leaking oil during the race and honestly should have been black flagged. I mean, it would have been a travesty and a tragedy had Parnelli not been an Indianapolis 500 winner, but had the rules been followed, he would have been black flagged. His car owner, J.C. Agajanian, was able to talk Harlan Fengler out of black flagging his car, saying, hey, the leak isn't leaking anymore, even though several other competitors said later that, including Eddie Sachs and a couple others, that, yeah, you know, we spun in Parnelli's oil and he should have been black flagged. So, yes, there absolutely was controversy about the fact, but Parnelli dominated that day. He led 167 laps. He was the class of the field. Would have been sad had he not won, but the rules were clearly not followed.
And Parnelli Jones, though, did take the checkered flag to win the Indianapolis 500-mile race in 1963, and this is how it sounded.
Pat Badan has the white flag out, and he is getting set to wave it for Parnelli Jones. Pick him up on the number one turn, Bill Frosch.
And here he comes into the number one turn, riding fairly low, following his usual pattern, coming up high and shooting down the short chute to Howard Bell.
Yes, we can see him now, and he's right down to that white line on this lap, too, as he streaks through here, right up onto the back stretch, and in just a second or so, Bernie Herman should be able to see him.
Okay, Howard, here comes Parnelli now, the Torrance man from California. White helmet, blue visor, and I'm sure he's going to be a very, very happy guy. And down to you, Mikey Hurd.
Okay, Bernie, we've got it. Here comes Parnelli Jones. He's passed as he gets around me here by Roger McCluskey. McCluskey spins there in the corner. Hold it. We've got one car going around him. He's sideways, the same spot that Eddie Sachs was. McCluskey right there. He's okay. He's sitting in his car. The cars are coming around him. We'll follow, see if it's all right. They're all going on the inside. McCluskey halfway through the turn, sideways, the exact same spot where Eddie Sachs was just a few minutes ago. Now they're running under the yellow flag. Jones went around us a moment ago. McCluskey passed him on the...
And there's the checkered flag for Parnelli Jones, the winner of the 1963 500-mile race. Parnelli Jones from Torrance, California, wins the 500.
So that's how it sounded in 1963. Mike, you could not only hear the controversy there, but, you know, and understandably so. Roger McCluskey spins, you could tell the enthusiasm, the excitement, the bewilderment, almost incredulous nature of Mike Ahearn, who, and understandably, was so focused on that, I think that he forgot about the fact that Parnelli Jones was getting ready to win the race. Sid Collins taking over the call there. But the point being, that was something that was, you know, at the end of the race there, a key component. But Parnelli Jones himself, when he pulled into victory lane, was relatively unaware, Mike, was he not, of the controversy that had taken place behind him?
Yeah, he didn't know that there was even a controversy, and then he didn't know that basically Agajanian had to talk Harlan Fengler out of, you know, throwing the black flag. And he later told me, he said, hey, if I would have been black flagged, he would have done the same thing Scott Goodyear did in 1995. He said, I wouldn't have come in. I wouldn't have acknowledged the black flag. But, you know, he didn't know at all that there was this controversy going on. He just thought everything was going okay until he was told about it later. And then there was a big to-do about it. I mean, there was no question. Eddie Sachs felt he spun in Parnelli's oil, and Roger McCluskey right there spun in oil that he believed at the time as well was Parnelli's oil. So there was a lot of controversy about it at the time.
And Eddie Sachs, when he would run into or be around Parnelli Jones, would mention often, apparently, that oil spill and the controversy thereof. And then finally, Parnelli said enough is enough. Here's Parnelli Jones talking about winning in 1963. And, well, Eddie Sachs gets a cameo in this as well.
Well, first of all, it was pretty close to the end of the race, and all of a sudden I came out of turn two, and gee, I about spun it. You know, oil came out on my left rear tire, and I mean, it was shocking. I mean, you know, it was like a instant thing that happened, and so then I slowed down, and you know, and went to a couple more corners and tried to build my confidence back, and it seemed to get better and better and better, and so finally, it obviously, I didn't know at the time, but the oil level had dropped down below the crack that was in the tank, and once it had did that, the only time it even had any coming out at all was when I backed off at the end of the straightaway. A little puff of smoke would hit the oil would hit the exhaust pipe, and that was it. And toward the end of the race, I run one of the fastest laps I run all day. So even though it was so oily, I was really disturbed when guys like Sachs and McCluskey and all that said that they spun in my oil. And I had a little altercation with Sachs the next day at the Autolite luncheon, and he called me, you know, said he spun my oil. And I tried, Eddie, you had a lot of problems. Your wheel come loose. And I think that's what caused you to spin. And they pushed him off and got him going again, and the wheel came off. But he said, he spun oil, he's making a big deal of it. And I said, well, I said, I'd have bust you in the mouth, you know, because he kept mouthing off. And so he said it one time too many, and I let him have it. So, and then he ran up into his room and put a black flag in his mouth and didn't show up at the banquet. So, and then press picked it up and stuff like that. But Eddie and I later were very good friends, and you have little altercations like that once in a while.
Mike, that's exactly what's happened to you and I a couple of times, right? I've just said to you, like, look, I should just bust you in the mouth, right? And then cooler heads prevail, and you get a black flag, and we're good to go, right?
Yeah, typically it's Nick Yeoman who says he's going to bust me in the mouth when we talk about Ohio State and Purdue. But
that's right.
And, well, actually, you and I do that with Clemson.
That's right,
well,
with Ohio State and Clemson. That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Unfortunately, Ohio State's busted Clemson in the mouth a few times, right? Parnelli, yeah, exactly. Jones, of course, would go on to win the 1963 Naples 500, as we talked about. That means that he became one of the members of one of the most famous groups in all of motorsports, an Indianapolis 500 winner, the BorgWarner likeness, all of it. Parnelli Jones on his thoughts on joining the most elite fraternity in motorsports, a winner, and being an Indianapolis 500 champion.
Yeah, it was a big thrill. I mean, you turn in and you suddenly, I mean, you have 400,000 people there, and you win the race. You know, like I said, it gives you a title, and there doesn't get any better than that. Well, that's kind of what you reach, you know, you work for, especially when I was coming up. Everybody kept saying, you're Indy material, you're Indy, you know. You always want to win Indy. I mean, if you don't win Indy, that's where you get your record, so to speak, somebody that gives you a title when you win there, not just another race driver. And so that was my whole desire, to win Indy. Not just to run Indy. And when I won, man, I couldn't believe it. I went to bed that night, and I don't know what time it was, but I fell asleep, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I run in there and looked in the mirror to make sure I wasn't dreaming. But it's that kind of thing. I mean, I had reached my goal. Like I said, it gives you a title. You're an Indy winner. And if you're not an Indy winner, you're kind of left in the background somewhat.
Not left in the background at all. 61 years ago, Parnelli won Indianapolis. We continue to celebrate him today. The man that we lost in early June, Parnelli Jones. The conversation as we return on the other side to Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool.
We're for Washington. We love Febreze's new scent.
Refresh and energize.
So much we made a song about it.
I'm John Morgan, here to urge you to vote yes on Amendment 3 and legalize the adult use of marijuana. There are a lot of reasons to vote yes on Amendment 3. But let me give you one more good one. Today, too many adults are sitting in our jails simply because they were using marijuana, and that is just wrong. If I was your governor, I would free or parole every person in jail for possession and then expunge everyone's record. Amendment 3 will put a stop to this and let the cops fight real crime, not fake crime. I'm tired of people being thrown in jail for something that is less harmful than alcohol or opioids. So now let's finish what I started and join me, John Morgan, in voting yes for the people and for Amendment 3.
Vote yes on Amendment 3. Paid political advertisement paid for by Smart and Safe Florida, 1400 Village Square Boulevard, Suite 3321, Tallahassee, Florida, 32312.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Almost 20 years ago, Andy Granatelli drove here at the Indianapolis 500. At a more recent 500, Andy Granatelli created a machine and a revolution with the STP turbine car. The man who heads up the STP division of Studebaker knows racing and cars.
Most of the drivers here at the 500 use STP oil treatment. It's the best method known of cutting friction.
At Indy, 3 out of 4 drivers have STP on their side. STP is the racer's edge.
STP works great in your family car, same as it does here at the Speedway.
STP keeps any car, old or new, running smoother, cooler, quieter, longer. Have your service station crew add STP to your oil.
When you hear the name Andy Granatelli, there are many great drivers with which he was associated, but Parnelli Jones is one of those in what was a bit of a surprise at the time. That will be one of the topics of conversation tonight on Beyond the Bricks. My name is Jake Query. Eddie Garrison puts it all together for us. That means putting together the voices of myself and Mike Thompson, the track historian and archivist of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, of course, the historian emeritus in official capacity, the only man to hold that title, Donald Davidson, who is close to both Mike and I. And then we began doing this program a few years ago upon Donald's retirement, utilizing the incredible audio archive that is the collection of Mike Thompson. And tonight we are paying tribute to Parnelli Jones, who passed in early June of this year, 2024, at the age of 90, the 1963 Indianapolis 500-mile winner, who is one of the legendary names of the Brickyard. And, Mike, the reality is this. There is so much content when it comes to Parnelli, not only from Parnelli Jones' voice, but also from others that he raced against or dignitaries of the Speedway, that I have a feeling this will not be the only show that we're going to be doing on Parnelli Jones.
Yeah, I think we'll do another one this week on Parnelli, and that'll be fun. And we're going to use a little bit of an interview you did with Mario, and got some Al Unser, and so really some interesting stuff on Parnelli later this week as well.
The thing about Parnelli Jones, and we'll get back into his driving career in the history thereof, Mike, but, you know, you had mentioned getting to know Parnelli Jones in his post-driving career, and my interactions with Parnelli Jones would have been strictly professional. I mean, essentially interview standpoints in his post-racing career, but there were many mutual friends, as you had commented, Mike. Steve Shunk, who has worked in public relations and was a very dear friend of Parnelli Jones. As a matter of fact, Steve has the watch that Parnelli was given for some of his accomplishments at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Robin Miller was very close to Parnelli Jones. The one thing that I would say, Mike, and to illuminate it for those that did not have the fortune of the two of us of being able to interact with or be around Parnelli Jones, one of the real true gentlemen in terms of not only when he would talk about his racing career, but just the humility overall, because I think most people would tell you that Parnelli's a guy that easily could have been a multi-year winner, but Parnelli never honed in on that, but rather talked about his blessing of winning the Indy 500 once and understanding all that goes into the near misses, but just a true gentleman of the sport.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, he was an absolute gentleman. Like I said, it was just such a joy for me to get to know him on the limited basis I did through Steve. I mean, I had met him a couple of times at autograph signings, but it's just one of those "Hi, Parnelli, how are you?" type things. But through Steve, you know, Steve brought him in to WIBC for me for several interviews that we did for Heroes of the 500, and I got to know him through that. And Parnelli and I got to talk about photographs. And, you know, Parnelli told me one time, he said, you know, everybody always brings me photographs of the 500, but he said, you know, nobody ever brings me, you know, stock car shots or sprint car shots or these different things. And so I sent him a pack of photos one time to his address through Steve, and Parnelli sent me some back signed of some other ones, and he wrote, you know, to Mike, my good friend, and, you know, thank you so much, you know, all these things on it. And I got a tear in my eye one of them because he wrote, you know, what a good friend I am to him and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, this is Parnelli Jones, man. This isn't, you know, it was just amazing. And you're right. He was an absolute gentleman, and he was so good with his time. I mean, we brought him, like I said, in for a couple times to WIBC for shows. And so we're using some of these clips tonight, and we're going to use them again later this week. And he was just so open with his time and really helpful to us launching Heroes of the 500 and things like that. So he was great, and he would talk about other drivers. I talked to him about Jim Clark and Don Branson and Bobby Marshman and all these guys he drove against. And he was very, very good about his time. And you know, he had a wry sense of humor, you know, telling the stories about, you know, he saved A.J. Foyt's life. I mean, A.J. Foyt had a terrible stock car accident, and the doctors literally told Parnelli as he was walking up there, don't go up there, he's dead. And Parnelli went up there and checked on him, and A.J. wasn't actually dead. He had some dirt that had gotten in his mouth from where the car had flipped at Riverside, and Parnelli reached in A.J.'s mouth, scooped all the dirt out, and said, you know, he's not dead, you know, and then they pulled him out, and he was injured, he was badly hurt, but Parnelli helped basically save AJ's life. And Parnelli was relaying those stories and, you know, basically saying, you know, I'm responsible for that guy being around and all that, you know, just the wry sense of humor he had about things. And they were very close, AJ and Parnelli. So, you know, he's just a gentleman, as you said.
And in 1967, Parnelli Jones, Mike, the reality is, because of that gentleman nature, I think a lot of people probably thought that Parnelli would be riding forever with the team with which he had won the Indy 500 and really made the name for himself. But the big surprise came, Mike, in 1967.
Yeah, what's interesting about Parnelli's career is people think, oh, he was running every IndyCar race, and he wasn't. In 66, he only ran twice. I mean, he ran the 500, and he ran at Phoenix in the finale. But, I mean, he wasn't running every race because he had other interests and things like that. And he had basically decided he wasn't, you know, he had a new family, and he was starting to kind of ease back on driving, you know, open cockpit cars and things like that. So, you know, he had almost basically decided at the end of 66 that was going to be the end of it. And so he got an offer to come out and look at Andy Granatelli's Turbine car. And Andy said, I really want you to drive this. And Parnelli was going, yeah, I don't think so. And Andy really romanced him and basically said, hey, this is what I want you to drive at Indianapolis. And ended up, Parnelli told me, you know, I made a financial decision because Andy made it to an offer I couldn't refuse at the time, basically.
It would become one of the most famous cars in Indianapolis, certainly of the 60s and the late 60s, the turbine engine, as Mike had mentioned. Parnelli Jones on his decision to drive that car for Andy Granatelli.
You know, the more curious I got about driving the car, you know, the more I kept thinking about it, you know, and he kept calling me, wanting me to drive it. So I let a financial decision make that decision, and I had no idea that it was going to be as good as it was race day. However, when I qualified the car, I run it obviously as fast as it would run, and you know, and I was sixth position on the second row on the outside. And but on race day, what happened on race day when all the top guys took that 10 or 15% nitro out and added 75 gallons of fuel in their car, they weren't able to run as quick as I could run because I had no nitro to put in or to take out of my car. I mean, I run just as fast race day as I did qualifying, so to speak, because all the fuel in the turbine car was right in the center of the car, and it didn't affect it as much. And Most people didn't give the car very much credit because of the handling ability of it, but it really handled well. And that's when they dropped the green flag. I just stuck it up in the gray around the outside and drove around everybody on the first corner except for Mario, and I caught him coming out of turn two, and he gave me the one lap sign, and that was the end of it. But everybody thought I was sandbagging, and of course during the month of May I had a lot of fun with that. But I kept telling Foyt and all that, Gurney and all them guys, I said, well, tell me how fast you're going to run on race day, because I want to know where to set the screw. So I really had a lot of fun doing that, and people were sending me sandbags in the mail and stuff like that, and had a lot of fun with it.
The reality is, in 1967, Mike, you heard him mention that it didn't take him long to catch up to Mario. It was Mario Andretti that over the course of his career would develop the reputation or probably be most associated with the hard luck nature of late car breakdowns and failures. But there are a few years where I think it jumps out more to people when talking about the tough luck for a driver of a car letting them down late than what happened with Parnelli Jones in 1967.
Yeah, when he talks about Mario giving him the one lap sign, that's not exactly the one lap sign. That's more of a gesture that you might give someone on the road when they cut you off in traffic. It's a little bit different. It's a
we call it the bird in some parts.
Yes,
right?
The bird, yes. A splendid gesture, as Monty Python would call it. But yeah, you're right. I mean, just a shocking end for a day that Parnelli dominated. I mean, he led 171 laps that day and looked like the car to beat. I mean, there was no one who could touch him. I mean, there was no one in the same zip code as Parnelli that day.
Inside of 10 laps from the end of the 1967 race, and it was a bearing failure that would drop Parnelli Jones from the 1967 Indianapolis 500.
But watch Parnelli Jones now. Ron Carroll on the number three turn. Ronnie?
And Sid, I must report, Parnelli Jones is almost at a halt on turn number four. He went by me clear under the white line, almost into the grass, and he's barely coasting around. Parnelli Jones in some kind of problem. Back to you, Sid.
Let's watch him pick him up on four, Jimmy Shelton.
It's unbelievable, Sid. Unbelievable. He is coasting in, and he looks like he is definitely out of this race.
I can't believe it.
I can't believe it either. I'm watching, and he is now barely moving.
And the reality is this. The public address you could hear couldn't believe it. The radio network couldn't believe it. But as he told Mike Thompson in an interview, our own Mike Thompson, Parnelli Jones knew when the engine was finished.
Going down the back straightaway, it just finally went into neutral. I mean, it was like taking the car out of gear. And, of course, it was a bearing in the quick change rear end that let go. And, one thing about the Turbin car, had a lot of torque. It didn't have so much horsepower, but it had a tremendous amount of torque, and it would accelerate, and be in a four-wheel drive car, it would hook up real hard coming out of the pits, and I didn't need to do that, you know what I mean? I needed to just have a little common sense and take it easy going out of the pits, and the thing would have run hands down.
The reality is this. For so many people, when they talk about Parnelli Jones, I think even that 67 race is the one that many who were there probably still in the back of their minds think that it was Parnelli, not A.J. Foyt, that won that day. It was not Parnelli Jones, obviously, despite, as Mike had mentioned, his domination and then that car just suddenly going into neutral and A.J. Foyt getting what would become, of course, the third of his four wins. But for Parnelli Jones, that feeling of what could have been in 1967 even sticks with him.
Well, I can best describe that by the next, I went to the banquet the next evening or whenever that, and the next day I left to drive home back to Los Angeles. And when I went to leave town, it was like leaving your house when you know you forgot something and you don't know what it is. And that feeling went on for a long time. And even when I came back the following year, I had the same feeling. And it took me a while to get over that feeling that just like I left something there. And I did.
There's that picture of you in the spring of 68 with Andy Granatelli where Jim Clark is in the wedge turbine about a few days before Jim Clark passed away. and you're back in the turban, the 67 turban, and there's almost this look on your face like I'm in behind the wheel of this car again. You know, I mean, like it is. It's almost like you described, like it's like I left something back there. Yeah. You know, that trophy that's supposed to be on the back of that car, where is it? You know?
Yeah. Well, that was a real empty feeling that I had after the race. And even for the next two or three years that I came to the Speedway, it got better every year. But you get over things like that. Like losing one of your best friends or something. But
Mike, it's interesting when it comes to the Indianapolis 500. You know, the saying has always been, maybe we've even overused it, that it's a track that selects its winner. With that, there are also oftentimes the track that seems to select that year's heartache or heartbreaker. Usually they end up balancing themselves out. I guess maybe that was the case for Parnelli Jones because he did get a win. She picked him one year, but boy, there were plenty of other years where he could have put his name right back on that BorgWarner.
Oh, there's no question. And it's interesting because Parnelli told me one time more people would ask him to sign the picture of the 1967 turban car than the car he actually won in. I mean, he would have people bring him the 63 car. And he said, but he goes, people bring me all the time the 67 car. And he just thought it was interesting. He goes, you know, I won in 63, but he said a lot of people bring me that 67 car. And he said, it just shows you how revolutionary and how much of a mark that 67 car made.
Yeah, one of the most famous cars in Speedway history. Absolutely no question about it. Mike, as you had mentioned, and by the way, thanks to everybody that showed up at the Memorabilia Show in May. I know it was a success. Thanks to those that purchased Mark Monteith's book at the Memorabilia Show that had heard about it on this program, but Beyond the Bricks. It is very much appreciated. We've been talking Parnelli Jones tonight. We will do it again later in the week. Wednesday, by the way, will be our next show. And if you're listening on podcast form, we appreciate that as well. Once again, it's always a pleasure to bring you Beyond the Bricks.